Welcome to New Books in Latin American Studies. My name is Álvaro Casovello, and today I will interview Professor Ricardo Di Salvatore to discuss his book Disciplinary Conquest, U.S. Scholars in South America, 1900-1945, published by Duke University Press in 2016. Ricardo Salvatore is plenary professor at Universidad Torcuato de Itela in Buenos Aires, Argentina. Professor Salvatore, welcome and thanks for joining us today.
Hello, welcome. It's a pleasure for me to talk to you and to your audience this morning.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So as it is usual here at the New Books Network, I wanted to start off by asking you about your own biography and intellectual trajectory. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and what do you consider to be both your academic training and your intellectual influences?
Well, I studied economics at the University of Córdoba in Argentina, and then I pursued a doctorate degree at the University of Texas in Austin. I graduated in 1987. While doing graduate studies, I started taking courses in history, although I graduated with a PhD in economics, and I was particularly interested in Latin American history. In the 1990s, I was a fellow and postdoc visiting professor in various U.S. universities and institutes, in particular at the Institute for Advanced Studies at Princeton in 1989, I believe. I came into contact with postmodern theory, questions about essentialism and the construction of the Orient and so on. And so I came to learn the first traces of post-colonial theory. I read Said's Imperial Orientalism. Then I spent some time at Yale and Harvard as either a fellow or visiting professor. And there I did some teaching and research. And I used these opportunities to read sources there at the archives. I read at Yale the archives of Hiram Bingham, and I read at Harvard the archives of Clarence Herring, and this started me into this project. Before going to Princeton, I have read Foucault in Argentina, and as a matter of fact, my first professional paper was on the birth of the prison in Argentina, and much later, already into, you know, halfway into the project of Disciplinary Conquest, I read Bruno Latour, and it just opened to me a new avenue for thinking.
And so just to follow up on that question, how do you think, so Disciplinary Conquest is about U.S. scholars and vision in South America in the early 20th century. So how do you think that your own experience as a Latin American who spent a substantial amount of time in the U.S. sort of influenced your approach to this topic, influenced sort of perhaps on a more personal level the types of questions that you're asking?
Yes. Well, my research in U.S. archives and universities was crucial for that. Not only my research on Bingham and Herring, you know, the Machu Picchu expedition and the beginnings of Hispanic American history at Harvard, but before that, I made a long trip to visit museums and historical societies in the northeast coast of the U.S., in places such as Boston, Baltimore, Philadelphia, searching for representations of Latin America and the USA in the late 19th century and early 20th centuries. And as a result of that, I published my first book, Imágenes de un Imperio, which itself was this is a 2006 book, which itself was drafted in first in the form of an article that came in Close Encounters of Empire, an edited volume with it with Gil Joseph and Catherine Legrand. And in that book, there is the discovery, so to speak, of First, an enormous and systematic process of accumulation of sources in U.S. institutions about Latin America in the first half of the 20th century. And secondly, the discovery that U.S. historians in Latin America took the area or the field, you know, Latin American history, for granted, while Latin Americans continue to do national history. So for us, Latin American studies was not a natural field. It was rather something of a historical creation that needed a further investigation and research.
Right, right, precisely. So the sort of the your approach to Latin American studies as an external observer clearly informed or at least denaturalized the concept itself and opened doors for you to historicize this subject. That's fascinating. So one of the theses advanced in the book is that there are certain disciplinary interventions made by five U.S. scholars that you follow in your book, and you mentioned some of them already. Hiram Bingham was one of them. Clarence Herring was another one. And you said that these disciplinary interventions were instrumental to U.S. hegemony as an imperial power. So I wanted to ask you a little bit more about this latter term, hegemony, and whether you see hegemony as a connecting topic of your previous work. I should tell the audience that you have worked extensively on caudillismo, on what you called wandering paisanos, and in the law in 19th century and particularly late 19th century Argentina, as you mentioned, also the prison system. So how would you call disciplinary conquest a sort of a variation in hegemony from studying the hegemonic power of the nation state in 19th century Argentina to study the hegemonic construction of an empire? Would that characterization be fair at all?
Yes, I think it is fair. I have been always interested in questions of domination, subordination, and hegemony since my early work on criminology and prison reform in Argentina. I was interested in hegemony and how the leading experts of the elite constructed criminal classes. Then I moved to the study of peasant state relations in mid 19th century Argentina. Out of that came my book Wandering Paisano of 2003. And then I move, as you notice, to the study of representations and cultural forms, and later to, imperial knowledge or imperial interventions of knowledge within the U.S. informal empire in the 20th century. And these are, came into one book in Spanish, Imágenes de un Imperio, and another more recent in English, Disciplinary Conquest. The difference between the study of peasants and the state in 19th century Argentina and that of, representations and knowledge in the building of U.S. hegemony in Latin America, apart from the question of the scale, the passage from national state-making to hemispheric cultural and knowledge relations, is one of focus and methodology. In my early studies of peasants, I dealt with fragments of subaltern lives, and hence I have to follow methods suggested by the subaltern history school. In my study in informal empire, I studied from the gaze histories and textual productions of imperial agents from the north. That is, I focus on those who were educated and powerful, and particularly experts, academics. So yes, you're right. I move from looking at domination and hegemony at the level of national state formation, and then to examining questions of hemispheric hegemony. Yes, there could be a common theme or a common preoccupation along the years. Because I consider, questions of power, domination, and hegemony are very important. Now, I should tell you, I'm back to studying 19th century Argentina. I have recently published and I'm working on questions of state violence during the Rosas dictatorship and questions of, back to questions of positive criminology and the construction of the dangerous classes. And this has to do because I'm back to Argentina and travel less to the US now.
So one of the other interventions you make in the book is that you displace the birth date of Latin American studies in U.S. academia. You offer an alternative history of the origins of Latin American studies. And you move away from the Cold War and you go back to the years of the dollar diplomacy and the good neighbor diplomacy. So, and you do so using a variety of sources. And one of the ways in which you engage in the book was by following the lives of these five U.S. traveling scholars, Hiram Bingham, an archaeologist, Leo S. Rowe, a political scientist, Isaiah Bowman, a geographer, Edward A. Ross, a sociologist, and Clarence H. Herring, a historian. So I wanted to ask you, what do you see as the uniting threads of the lives of these five men? Well, they're all of them are academics in some capacity or another. But what other connecting aspects do you see uniting their lives and their work to actually sort of bring them together in your book?
Well, you asked me about, you know, the common elements that, of these five scholars. I think the first reply would be that they all entered into this great curiosity about rediscovering Latin America, better understanding the region, and as they considered it was, you know, not very well known, or at least not, you know, understood by in a scientific way. So I would say that first curiosity and then a will to know motivated all these scholars to spend time and develop generalizations and specific studies about Latin America in the early 20th century. This at a certain time became sufficiently widespread, you know, the studies or the information coming out of this area, as to produce many scientific panoramas about the region, and this is reflecting in the way they talk about Latin America. They talk of Latin America as being, or South America, which was their principal object of inquiry, as terra incognita, as a, you know, an unknown land, as if it hasn't been, you know, traced or mapped by previous scholars. And they see themselves as rediscoverers of a subcontinent, which is very curious. Yeah. And I mentioned in, you know, a few passages how, you know, Isaiah Bowman saw again, you know, the desert of Atacama and certain features, and how Hiram Bingham considered himself, you know, as a second Pizarro. So there are all these self-identifications with, you know, second discoverers. And so the curiosity and the will to know united these efforts. Then there was this series of activities that put them together. They probably crossed paths in, you know, in their universities, at conferences, you know, they read each other's publications. And so these were the activities that characterized the building of the subdisciplines that later made or constituted the field of Latin American studies. And so they developed a series of institutions and programs that gave transcendence to their work. For example, the American Geographical Society, journals like the Hispanic American Historical Review, and others. And so there are, you know, this curiosity and this institutional settings made them connect to each other and at the same time connect to the preoccupations of the State Department. And you're right, all these activities and efforts belong to the period 1906-1945 rather than to the post-1959 Cuban Revolution.
Right. So a quick follow-up on that is that, do you see this man as being exponent of a particular social class? For example, you mentioned how Hiram Bingham after went on and became a senator, if I remember correctly from the book. And some of them, you mentioned that envisioned themselves as sort of gentlemanly scholars. So in the way that, to a certain extent, the conquistadors sort of belong to a sort of lower sort of class of hidalgos in Iberia. Do you see the second conquistadors as belonging to the same social class?
Well, they probably belonged, you know, to an educated middle class in America. And since they were very successful in their professions, Hiram was an international known man, the same as Isaiah Bowman. And so they all work in prestigious institutions and achieve, you know, a sociability that probably connected them, you know, middle-class experts with people in power or the higher classes in America. But their work does not represent the view of a particular social class. I would say that they write and as experts that are trying to understand better a continent. So they have more of a kind of ascription to the professional class.
So I think that one of the most powerful aspects of your book along the lines of what you're describing is that it's not a simplistic narrative. And you show both how some of these disciplinary interventions were contested on the ground by peoples in the Americas, but also by this some of the scholars themselves who at least offered caveats to the way that American business interests or the U.S. State Department sort of established priorities in terms of the construction of hemispheric hegemony in the Americas. So could you talk to the listeners a little bit more about this tensions both on the ground and at the center? And to a certain extent, do you think that American domestic policy, U.S. domestic policy in this very momentous time in the U.S., sort of after the First World War, then with the Great Depression, how did that influence the work of your five traveling scholars?
The vision of U.S. scholars was more complex and at times ambivalent and even contradictory with earlier works than those of U.S. diplomats and business travelers to Latin America. Business travelers were interested in the diversity, that is, in the internal differences within the subcontinent and within regions in a nation, yet they provided a sort of catalog description of the countries and an inventory of resources, natural resources and population, and popular costumes, costumbres, más bien. And many of them look specifically at the question of consumer power and the consumer, whereas diplomats usually have conversations with Latin American statesmen and reach rapid and general conclusions about, you know, issues such as government, law, economic development, national debt, or American investments. They built more slogans about what had to be done, like, you know, mutual understanding, useful knowledge, intellectual cooperation. They were sort of slogans. They were not, I mean, the diplomats were not inclined for a deep understanding or a study of the region. In my case, Leo Rowe, the director of the Pan-American Union and the only political scientist in my study, is perhaps the exception. He was a diplomat and a scholar, and perhaps there are other cases of that combination of expertise. But the scholars that I study that went to South America in the early 20th century to better understand the region were attentive to regional and local differences, to country peculiarities. Yet more importantly, their gaze or their vision was informed by certain presuppositions that they carried from their formative education. They carried to South America, most of them, a kind of progressive ideology that led them to criticize social inequalities, local elite perceptions, and what they call the Hispanic heritage. So you're right, on the ground, they pose new questions whose answers may even contradict, you know, the established consensus among business leaders and the State Department. Yes, I think that the construction of Latin America as a field for intervention, for U.S. capital, technology, and expert advice were, in general, more contested and more conflictive process than we usually tend to think.
So what, one thing you just mentioned in your answer is sort of the influence of the progressive ideas in these intellectuals, sort of drawing from the progressive movement in the U.S. politics and particularly also in U.S. intellectuals at the time. So do you see a move away from the dollar diplomacy of in the early period towards a more sort of state-sponsored projection of soft power by mechanisms of cooperation in the late 1930s and early 40s?
Yes, these are the scholars who discover this question of Latin American distrust, which was a form of anti-Americanism. They call it Latin American distrust. And they discover it early in the century, let's say in the 1910s. Some of them, like Clarence Herring, did a whole tour in 1926 make inquiries about this issue of anti-Americanism, and he made a list of all the anti-imperialist leagues and all the anti-American intellectuals in Latin America, and this was a preoccupation that had to do. So they discovered that South Americans were uncomfortable with U.S. policies in Central America and the Caribbean, and it was soon enough. Some of these scholars started to write against U.S. interventions in Nicaragua. The other wanted to change the Monroe Doctrine to become a multilateral kind of policy. There are many signs that these scholars were shifting away from dollar diplomacy and towards a more multilateral and differential approach to U.S. relations in Latin America.
So you just gave me a perfect segue into my following question, which is one of the interventions or arguments you advance in the book is the idea of the creation of smaller divergences within Latin American studies. And you characterize, I think, very, very well, that one of the most notorious differences elaborated by these scholars in the early 20th century is the divergence between South American studies, quote unquote, and Mexico, Central America, and the Caribbean. And so within South American studies, some of your scholars were proponents of what you call ABC exceptionalism, or the idea that the prospects shown by the so-called ABC republics, Argentina, Brazil, Chile, and by extension, Uruguay, were were really different than other countries in Latin America, and they were particularly enamored of democratic advancement in these ABC republics during the first third of the 20th century. So I wanted to ask you, how did these scholars react when, in the 1930s in particular, a series of military coups sort of ended precipitously and rather almost simultaneously democracy in all of these republics? Were they completely sort of disillusioned, or did they envision other mechanisms to actually reinvigorate democracy in these regions?
So this is a good question. I'm not sure that this is well answered in my book. I have pieces of that, of the answer to that question, but not a comprehensive answer. Yes, I argue that this collective knowledge enterprise produced an enduring division in the field. I call this the Great Divide in my book, that South America was different than Mexico, Central America, and the Caribbean, and that in turn, South America itself was divided into a bunch of progressive nations in the Southern Cone, the, as you mentioned, the ABC powers, and the other group of backward nations in the Andean region, like Peru, Bolivia, and Ecuador. This solid construction was put in doubt by the series of coups that followed the 1929 crash in New York. I have not identified the change in all the scholars about this peculiar moment in the history of Latin America, as I should have. But I did follow the writings of Clarence Hearing, who, because he was a sort of informant for the Council of Foreign Relations, he wrote a series of papers and articles on the political changes in Latin America during these early years of the 1930s. And he was very worried about this, and this contradicted what he had been saying. And also, it is clear that Bowman, the geographer, was quite worried about Nazi infiltration in South America. Other scholars that I examined did not write much about this, about the early 30s and the coups. My view is that these scholars, judging for what Hearing wrote, took this disturbances as temporary deviations from the historical trajectory that would come to an end and go back to the path. And that, you know, Southern Cone exceptionalism continued after the recovery, after the end of the recession, 1935, 1937 for some other countries. In fact, this is remarkable how little attention these scholars devoted to the new political authoritarian regimes in Argentina, Brazil, and Mexico. I mean, Vargas, Perón, Cárdenas. Perhaps I didn't look quite closely at this issue or should have studied the work of other U.S. scholars. But Leo Rowe, which was the main man, I mean, he was the director of the Pan-American Union and the key man in U.S.-Latin American relations, until the end of his life in 1945, he was a very enthusiastic believer in the, you know, what he called development of democracy in the continent and in the pioneering role of, you know, the ABC nations. Even though we all know that, you know, Perón came to power, in this particular ending years of his life.
Right, right. So that's fascinating how they grappled with that sort of seeming contradiction. So one of these ABC republics is Brazil, and I wanted to devote a couple of minutes to Brazil. Among the five scholars you mentioned in your work, it seems that only Clarence Hearing thought extensively about Brazil, and the characterization of South America they seem to offer, with the exception perhaps of Hearing's work, appears very Spanish American. And I wanted to ask you if this was true at all in general, and whether they they were collapsing Brazil and Luso-America within Spanish America, and that they used Spanish America and Hispanic customs, as you mentioned, as sort of shorthand for everything Iberian and, to a certain extent, pre-modern.
Yes. Perhaps by the selection of the scholars I made, Brazil appears less into the picture. In Bowman, for example, in Bowman's geography, Bowman's geography handbook, Brazil appears prominently as a frontier agricultural society. And later on, when Bowman comes back to the study of agricultural frontiers in the world, he puts, the Mato Grosso as a prominent area. For Haring, the Brazilian Empire appears as a less interest in his work. I mean, he published this book about the Brazilian Empire after retiring. So my idea is that Brazil entered into Latin American studies quite lately, perhaps in the late 20s and early 30s. I'm just guessing. I know that that is a time when some universities hired Brazilian historians. But in many of these writings, Brazil continued to be a kind of undeveloped country, the land of the future. So they were trying to map also Brazil, but I'm afraid that Brazilian studies took longer time to develop and integrate into Latin American studies. And so I guess to acquire a critical mass, and it has today, it was a phenomenon of the 40s and the 50s, I guess. The U.S. had a long interest in Brazil, but I think it is in the 40s when they invite Freire and other scholars to talk about Brazil in the U.S.
Interestingly enough, your answer sort of puts us towards the more standard time in which we tend to think about the rise of Latin American studies in the context of the late 50s and the Cold War and the sort of the rise of also other area studies. So I wanted to ask you which are the connecting topics between the early iterations of Latin American studies that you work on in your book and the later more standard narrative that we know about Latin American studies and the in the context of other area studies.
Well, as you know, my book stopped at 1945 approximately. Later on in the 1960s, the reasons for studying Latin America changed. There was the imperative of development, financial and technological aid from the Truman era onwards. Then there was the fear of an impending social revolution spreading through the region. And there was also better and more solid and more dense institutionalization of the field of Latin American studies. To the extent that the new book by Tenorio Trillo, Latin America, the Allure and Power of an Idea, calls this idea of Latin America in the 60s the textbook version of Latin America, a little ironically. And so the idealization of, peasants, indigenous peoples, and the revolutionary potential of the Latin American masses of workers and students perhaps damaged many of the subtleties and differences built by the early builders of Latin American studies before this, the 1959. Latin America became the land of redemption for, the failure of, bringing equality in capitalist U.S. society. So this view that I consider rather you know, romantic or erroneous, was not there in the early efforts to rediscover the region. But this is only a speculation, and perhaps, you know, the readers or your audience should consult Berger's study Under Northern Eyes, which gives a wonderful description of how Latin American studies turned to be after the Cuban Revolution. So the audience should trust more Berger than my intuition about how the field changed in the second period.
Perhaps both books should be read in conversation.
Yes,
with each other.
Yes, I agree with it.
Professor Salvatore, thank you so much for your time and for this conversation.
Thank you, Alvaro, and good morning to all the audience. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
The book we discussed was Ricardo D. Salvatore's Disciplinary Conquest, U.S. Scholars in South America, 1900-1945, published by Duke University Press in 2016. Special thanks to the Johns Hopkins University Radio Studios in Baltimore. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the New Book Networks on your favorite platforms or listen to our podcasts by going to newbooksnetwork.com. We hope you enjoyed this conversation and see you next time.